This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. Today on the program, we discuss a report published by the Abel Foundation called The Chesapeake Bay and Agricultural Pollution, the Problem, Possible Solutions, and the Need for Verification. That's coming up in the second half hour. First, we're about to have a conversation about the incinerator in Curtis Bay, or the incinerator is being planned for Curtis Bay, I should say, and the struggle we've been covering over the last several years of people in the community, started by the young people at Ben Franklin High School who opposed this and brought this to the attention of the community and to the larger community. And we covered this a great deal, and they got over 20 institutions to say they would not take electricity from this incinerator, and now it's back on the front burner again. We asked Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake on our program the other week about this, and she said she didn't know anything about it. She couldn't answer the question. And so we're having two people with us in the studio now who can answer the question. Greg Sautel is the leadership organizer for United Workers working in that community. Destiny Walford Watford is a leader of Free Your Voice and United Workers. She's a junior at Towson, but she was in Ben Franklin when all this started, was one of the student leaders then, and still a student leader, just a little older. Yeah. Good to have you both back in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. So we can hear what the mayor and I had to say about this. What popped in my head as you were describing that was a program we did here not long ago. I've been covering it pretty intensely over the last several years, which has to do with the Curtis Bay community and the incinerator that many people in that community wants to stop, the medical incinerator that would burn 4,000 pounds of waste a day and 240 pounds of mercury, as I was just reading about, per year would come out of that, and other pollutants. Pollutants as well. So what about that right in our backyard? Does the mayor's office have a position on this incinerator and whether or not it should be allowed to be built? Because it seems like the company is moving ahead despite what happened before.
Yeah, so I don't have the information on exactly what pollutants are being released as a part of that incinerator. I can certainly get back to you after I get the full information.
But right now the city doesn't have a position on whether or not they support or don't support the idea of the incinerator being built.
You want me to make a decision or give you an opinion without information, so I'm not going to do that.
So, you know, now we've heard this, and I think, Greg, you said to me after we talked about this that, and you heard this first, that you couldn't understand why she didn't know about this beforehand.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. For one, we're talking about the nation's largest trash-burning incinerator being built in Baltimore City. In a community that has the highest levels of toxic air emissions in the entire state and recently in the entire country. And for the mayor of a city to say that she doesn't have the facts or is unaware or simply can't take a position on the issue, is shocking to say the least.
So where is all this? I mean, take us just back for just a second, Destiny, to the beginning, when that was, of the struggle and when you became aware of this and how this got organized in the first place, just briefly so people can get a context of where we are today.
Yeah, sure. So the Stop the Incinerator campaign started around 2012, at the end of 2012, when we learned about the plan to build the nation's largest trash-burning incinerator from being built less than a mile away from our school. At that time, I was a senior at Benjamin Franklin High School, and folks were just learning about it, despite the fact that the project had been going on since 2009, which was insane. And so from then, we learned and we researched about the project, about incineration itself and the issues and the pollution that it could cause to the community. And we relayed those facts and we told the community about what we had learned. And we built up this larger network of people, of experts, like environmental experts, of doctors, of all these different people and artists coming together to really hone in on this issue and try to figure out how we can stop it and what do we do after we stop it. I mean, a lot of amazing things came out of this campaign, one of which was that, like, for instance, there were 22 entities that would be public entities that would be buying energy from the incinerator, and we got all of them to back out of their contracts with the project.
Museums in Baltimore, I mean, major institutions, right?
Yeah, including Baltimore City Public Schools.
I forgot this. We went to the school board meeting. There was a whole intense thing with the school board you went through.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was actually a really, really big part of our campaign. We called it the divestment campaign, where we went to these different institutions and we tried to get them to get out of their contracts with the incinerator. But yeah, the Baltimore City Public School System was one of the biggest contributors or the largest buyer of energy for the incinerator. And it was especially shocking to us because we were a Baltimore City Public School or students of a Baltimore City Public School. So we got all of those entities, including the school system, get out of their contracts. And that was amazing. We even got Baltimore City to get out of their contracts. And the mayor herself even said that, you know, even though she supported the project back when it was proposed, she can no longer support it, and Baltimore City can't support it any longer.
So what happened, do you think? I mean, if we got to a point, how many years ago was this? 4 years ago, right?
Right.
When this began.
4 years.
So what happened? I mean, if 4 years ago the mayor said this is not a good idea, and 4 years ago this company could not build it, all of a sudden the mayor can't tell us what she thinks about this, and the company is saying they're going to construct this incinerator, not calling it incinerator, they're calling it a power plant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what happened?
Well, one thing that happened is that community members have built power.
Yeah.
The quote that Destiny just mentioned from the mayor actually happened just earlier this year, mm-hmm. of the mayor saying that she could no longer support the execution of this project. So that makes it even stranger to know what happened between earlier this year and now, where now she's unable to simply restate what she said months ago, that she could no longer support the project. We know that this project has a long history of making major financial contributions to officials and political leaders throughout the state.
Including the mayor?
Including the mayor, including former Governor O'Malley. We know that a law was passed which redesignated trash burning incineration as tier one renewable energy in the state of Maryland, which means it's on the same level as wind and solar, which means that public money would go to support this incinerator and the energy that it would produce, which has been greenwashed as renewable energy. So we know this company's put a lot of effort into evading laws, passing new laws. They would really remap the landscape in here in Maryland to make it, you know, fit a project like this.
So the company is called Energy Answers, right?
Yeah.
They're the ones who want to build this facility. Mm-hmm. But it has to go through a process still with the Department of Environment in the state. So where are we? I mean, because everything I've read acts like as if they're actually going to do this. There's nothing stopping them.
I think that kind of brings up the urgency of the December 15th event.
What's December 15th?
So there's this huge – I can talk about that a bit later, but – basically, we're having this huge event on December 15th at the MDE, the Maryland Department of the Environment, because to answer your question, so there is a long process that you have to go through, and I'm not an expert on this process, but what I do know is that Energy Answers, since 2009, they constantly had the construction was constantly delayed, and they had to wait and wait to construct. And so in 2012, when we started to add pressure, and folks were fighting this incinerator before we even knew about it, but when we started to add pressure and call the project into question, we've been doing this for 4 years, and now they're saying that they're going to start construction in 2016, despite there being this long lack of construction for an extended period of time.
So where are we now?
So where we are now is that the facts are that Energy Answers, the New York-based company trying to build the incinerator, their permits expired.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they've not done any construction at the site since November of 2013, and that's not Destiny or myself saying that. That's according to Maryland Department of the Environment's own inspection reports, which have now been reported on in local media. And so the permit is very clear in stating that there cannot be an 18-month gap in construction. So community members have been monitoring the site for years now to just be watchdogs on the ground. We actually had a run-in with the CEO of the company while we were doing that monitoring, and Destiny can maybe share a little bit about what that was like. But the point is we've been monitoring, MDE has been monitoring, and the facts are clear. The company's not done anything since November 2013. There's been more than an 18-month gap. And we've been presenting those facts to Maryland Department of the Environment since August with official letters, with thousands of petitions, with video testimonies. And the response, much like the mayor's response, has been confusing, frustrating. It's been a mix of silence and unclear answers. So what community members then did was a small delegation of community residents went down to Maryland Department of the Environment headquarters, which is down at 1800 Washington Boulevard at the old Montgomery Park building, and gave MDE a 30-day deadline. They said, look, we've been petitioning you guys for months. The facts are clear. We're expecting a response. You haven't given us one, so we're going to give you guys a deadline. That deadline comes up on Tuesday, December 15th, which is next Tuesday. And so that's going to be a space for the thousands of people who have raised their voice and taken a stand on this issue to simply follow through, to say, look, we're citizens, we're residents, we have an expectation that our government's going to follow through and do the basic of enforcing the law. And so that action on next Tuesday is going to be a time for everybody to come and raise their voice and make it clear that that's our expectation.
And the mayor's office nor any of our state delegates have said anything to you about where they stand on this, what they're going to do to help or intervene?
The mayor's stance has been shaky. I mean, she said that she was in favor of the incinerator, then she withdrew her support from the incinerator. Now she said that she doesn't have the information. But as far as we're concerned, it seems as though she's still in favor, but it doesn't make sense to support the incinerator anymore.
One of the things I read before you all came in was the op-ed piece that was written last month, November 9th, in the Baltimore Sun by Dr. Gwen Du Bois, or Du Bois, how is her name, an internist at Sinai, part of the board of the Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility, and a part of the Public Health Committee of MedChi, which is the medical organization of physicians in our city. And she just listed, she said that the proposed incinerator would burn 1.46 million tons of waste a year, 156 tons of fine particulate matter linked to lung cancer, premature death and heart attacks, 446 tons of sulfur dioxide that is in fine particulate matter that causes acid rain, 601 tons of nitrogen oxides that will cause a reduction in lung function of children. And she labeled all these things and that Baltimore cannot keep up with the high ozone levels coming out of our communities. And this would emit another 1,000 pounds of lead and 240 pounds of mercury yearly into the air, reducing IQs of little children. I mean, all these medical links. And so what are people saying about this? I mean, NJ Anderson says this is the green answer to our problems.
Yeah. I mean, on the ground, we're basically what we do as organizers is we talk to folks. When we learn stuff, we go and we listen to people in the community. We knock on doors in Curtis Bay. And what we hear, people are up. People are educated on this issue now on the ground in Brooklyn. It wasn't in Curtis Bay. It wasn't like that 4 years ago because there wasn't transparency about this issue. Now people are reading. They're educated. And what we hear is that people are deeply, deeply concerned. We met a person the other day who said, you know, I just had a child, a young child. I'm a young professional. I live here with my husband. And we'd have to leave the community if this was built. Now, that's what we're hearing is that people are deeply concerned about the impact that this project would have on the community that they call home. And all of those numbers, all of the data that's out there, that's merely what the project has been permitted to release. This project's been permitted to be the worst source of mercury in the entire state of Maryland.
And in another poor working class community, is it true that the zip code is 21226?
Yeah, 21226.
Has the highest amount of pollutants of any community?
Has some of the highest air pollution in the nation or from stationary facilities and some of the worst air quality in Baltimore, air pollution in Baltimore and air quality in Baltimore.
So I remember when we talked, when this all started, there was some conflict between the students and the community who opposed the building of this plant, who wanted jobs and with you. So where does that stand? I mean, how is that conflict inside the community? Is it still there with any intensity or?
As far as folks wanting.
Wanting to see it built because they want jobs.
Yeah. I mean, that's always a common. It's not. We don't hear that argument often, but it is an argument, and it's one of the benefits that the incinerator said that it would have. But the fact is that, and something that we've been looking into, is the fact that some possible alternatives that we've been coming together to learn about as community members and looking to invest in instead of the incinerator, like solar or recycling plants or reuse facilities, would produce or could produce more jobs, better jobs that don't put our lives at risk. And so I think the issue there is that we want to invest in developments that will give us jobs, a small amount of jobs. The incinerator isn't offering very many jobs. And most likely those jobs won't be from or given to people in the community. And so something that we want to invest in as a community and that we've been working together to try to figure out is, okay, so if we don't have the incinerator, how can we still have jobs mm-hmm. and have that available for community members? But to not do that in a way that put our lives at risk or violates our basic human rights to live in a healthy community.
When I saw you all at the Institute for Policy Studies last year, whatever that was, a year and a half ago, when you spoke at that series of meetings that they had that afternoon, one thing is, Greg, I remember you talking about and other people were talking about with you was a consultant who came in and talked about the green energy business that could be built in its place. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, and actually Neil
Seldman. That's what Destiny was referring to.
Yeah,
right?
There's a whole range of possibilities here, some of them on the energy side and some on what do we do with waste. We know that Baltimore City's got a trash crisis, you know, in terms of illegal dumping, vacant homes being filled up with trash. These issues are all deeply interconnected. And so just like Destiny was saying, we've been working on a process that's truly participatory, includes residents, and that's also informed by people who bring decades of experience working in similar communities where a community is dumped on for years, an incinerator comes in, says we're going to build here, community learn about it, say no, and then find themselves saying, well, we've built power, what do we want to do? And so it was great. Some of this is being reported on now that there's a whole range of possibilities that a group called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance that's been partnering with the community for several years now. And they range from some of the stuff people are already doing, like community composting. There's an amazing community garden called the Filbert Street Garden, run by an amazing member of the community named Rodette Jones. And she's been partnering with Neil from the Institute to learn how to scale up some of those initiatives. So we're taking then food scraps, and instead of that being sent to a landfill or an incinerator, you're putting that to productive use, creating jobs in the process. There is a paper recycling company based right now in Canada that's looking to build facilities here in Baltimore. They could build two facilities, and they would each produce between 100 and 150 jobs, wages starting at $15 an hour and up. With benefits, even opportunities for community ownership of the business, and so we're learning about this stuff. Community members are taking their time vetting these projects according to a set of principles that are based on our basic human rights before we come to any decisions about what we want to do.
And this is also tied to all the issue of recycling. I mean, Baltimore had, our recycling is abysmal in the city.
Yeah,
I mean it was. If I have this right, we had a 27% recycling rate, which was really low, and it dropped to 19.4% in 2013. Seattle and other places like that are almost – and D.C. is way ahead of us in terms of mm-hmm. of using this. They're saying the reason – this would take the place of recycling because we could burn up all this trash and turn it into energy, and we don't need recycling if we have this. But –
And the large reason for our abysmal recycling rate right now, and there's a lot of reasons. One is that recycling represents an investment in labor. So when we talk about jobs, we need to be talking about recycling. When you build an incinerator, it's a capital investment with very few jobs. Incineration burns jobs. Right now, Baltimore City burns most of its municipal waste at the Bresco incinerator. And we've got a track record on that facility. It's the worst polluter in the state in the city. It's the worst source of mercury, and it's driving a lot of negative health outcomes for people, particularly in South Baltimore. And so the idea that we double down on incineration right now and build the largest incinerator in the country, given the track record that's right in front of us with the incinerator we already have, is mind-boggling. One bombshell that was recently released is that this new incinerator would be importing 100% of its waste from outside of Baltimore City. We don't know where it would come from. The city has told us they don't know where it would come from. So maybe the mayor was right in that some of the facts aren't here, which is shocking that we would be moving forward with a project of this scale without even knowing where the garbage is coming from.
So before we close on this, we'll come back to this again and bring you all back. We've got to follow this very closely and see what's going on. So again, the dates, December 15th.
December 15th. It's on a Tuesday.
Right, on a Tuesday.
The rally or the event starts at 4. The address is 1800 Washington Boulevard. It's the Montgomery Park Building and the MDE headquarters.
Which is where they're headquartered in mm-hmm. Southwest Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so and what's the deadline for the Department of Environment to make a decision?
It's the 15th. The 15th is the deadline.
That is the deadline.
That the community has given them. And so this event is either going to be a massive celebration where MDE's done the right thing and enforced the law, or it's going to be saying, MDE, you need to do the right thing. You need to enforce the law. And so all Marylanders have been invited to come out to this event who've taken a stand on this issue and want to ensure that our Maryland Department of the Environment has heard their voice and is going to take the necessary action.
Well, we will check in with you next week. We'll check after Tuesday, I mean to say, see what happens and where we take this and what's going on. And good luck with this. And I'm really glad you could join us in the studio today. And we're going to find out more about this and see how this happens on Tuesday the 15th. So I want to thank you both for being here. We've been talking here with Greg Sawtell, who is a leadership organizer, United Workers, in Curtis Bay, Brooklyn. Destiny Watford, who was a young woman when she was a senior at Ben Franklin High School, created and helped create Free Your Voice to stop this incentive from being built. She's now a junior at Towson University, still organizing with Free Your Voice and United Workers. So Destiny and Greg, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll be talking about the report published by the Able Foundation called The Chesapeake Bay and Agricultural Pollution, the problem, possible solutions, and the need for verification. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. Today on the program, we discuss a report published by the Able Foundation called The Chesapeake Bay and Agricultural Pollution, the Problem, Possible Solutions, and the Need for Verification. It was written by Rona Coble, who joins us in studio. She's a staff writer for the Chesapeake Bay Journal and has been in the news business for 20 years, spending 10 years with the Sun. Also was the former Secretary of Environment, Dr. Robert Summers, and Dr. Tom Simpson, who directed a nonprofit focusing on continuous improvement programs for agricultural water runoff. And Tom Horton, who we know as somebody who has been teaching about the Bay and writing about the Bay for the last 40 years and also was a former Sun columnist who lives on the Eastern Shore and is a son of Delmarva. And joining us in studio, as I said, is Rona Coble, who helped edit this entire thing and was part of this report. And Rona, good. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So one of the interesting things that at the very beginning of the report, it talked about, you know, why would Able Foundation want to worry about the Chesapeake Bay when its focus is on mostly Baltimore City and urban poverty?
It's a good question, and it was one of our questions too when they asked us to do this report. Uh-huh. And one of the reasons that they wanted to undertake it is that we're all familiar with the stormwater fee that we're all being asked to pay, or at least in Baltimore County, maybe being relieved of having to pay.
Right.
But at some point, we're going to have to pay something for our stormwater, and so the urban sectors are being asked to do more and more, paying for stormwater and upgrades to sewage treatment plants, which we pay for on our water bill. And that has to do with regulation, whereas the agriculture sector of the United States is largely exempt from the Clean Water Act. So what they undertake is largely voluntary. So they put practices in on their land to reduce pollution, like forested buffers or drainage ditch structures or cover crops. They get paid by the federal government to do some of that. They pay for some of it by themselves. But it's those practices are voluntary. And the second part of it, which is what Dr. Summers focused on, which is extremely important, is that those practices are often put in and paid for, but there is very little monitoring money to make sure that they work, and there is not an independent verification to make sure that the practices that we said we were going to put in, we actually have put in, and that they're getting the reductions that they're getting credit for getting.
So a couple of things here. First, what is the history that forced the Clean Water Act not to oversee agriculture as it does urban sewage systems?
initially, the Clean Water Act applied to everybody.
That's what I thought. Right.
But the farm lobby at the time in the 70s got themselves an exemption. And I used to say that that exemption is the gift that keeps on giving. But I actually don't think it's that much of a gift to the farmers because it creates a lot of confusion. And there are a lot of areas where people don't necessarily know, is this regulated? Is this not regulated? And for example, agriculture stormwater is not regulated as a point source the way sewage treatment is. Mm-hmm. So when you have runoff from a farm, is that agriculture stormwater or is that what the EPA might call a processed water of waste, which they could technically regulate? And so there have been a lot of lawsuits in the whole country, in Chesapeake Bay region, but also the dairy industry and the pork industry have filed lawsuits against the EPA over their authority to regulate these things because the law is vague because of those exemptions. Whereas for sewage treatment, the law is not vague. You violate your permit, you are going to be prosecuted or fined or something's going to happen to you, or you'll at least be told to stop. With agriculture, it's just a whole different animal, I guess we could say.
Well, I mean, and farmers will say and have said many times in this program and elsewhere that they're always being asked to verify something. There's tons of paperwork they have to put out. They have to have cover crops, as you write about in this report. They have to kind of measure the phosphorus and nitrogen in the ground. They know what they're doing. So, but this report in some ways paints a different picture than that.
There is absolutely a lot of paperwork that farmers have to do, and especially if the farmer is a concentrated animal feeding operation, which we call a CAFA, which means basically two or more large chicken houses on your property or more than a certain head of cows or large heads of cows.
Right. Right.
We don't have too many dairy CAFOs in Maryland. We have a lot of chicken CAFOs. So there's paperwork, but then is that paperwork actually verifying? For example, Maryland Department of Agriculture used to check about 4% of all farms to make sure they had nutrient management plans and that those plans were being followed. Now they're up to about 8% of farms, which means 92% of farms don't get a visit for years.
But they still have to put a plan in, don't they? They have to file a plan.
Whether or not they've implemented that plan, we don't know. Other than for the animal feeding operations, the plans are not open to the public. So we can see the plan for the animal feeding operations. You can ask for that and you can see it. But the plan for the grain farmers and the soybean farmers is proprietary and you can't see it. And one of the problems that we have, Mark, is that we have the chicken manure is generated on the poultry farm, which is regulated. But then it goes to a corn or soybean farm, which is not regulated. So we don't necessarily know how much manure a farmer is putting on a particular field and if it should maybe not go on that field because that field is close to a creek. That information is not only not available to us, but in a lot of ways it's not available to regulators.
And they can act, and that could be the same farm as it is in many cases.
Yes, it could be.
Right?
It could be the same farm.
Because most farmers that I know and have met, interviewed across the shore, they have chicken houses, but they also grow soy and they also grow corn and they for the industry and have other fields as well. So, I mean, so they're usually that kind of farm that does many more things than just one thing.
Right. That is changing somewhat, as you know, in Somerset County and in Wicomico County, we're moving towards this sort of big chicken where there are maybe 10, 12 chicken houses on a small piece of land and they have no crops. And so that manure is being generated on the regulated sector and moving to the unregulated sector. I think what you're speaking of is, I don't want to say exactly being phased out, but we're seeing a lot less of that, you know, sort of the mom and pop operation
where there's
like, you know, 1,000 acres of corn and soybean and 2 chicken houses. I think we're starting to see that change to either get out of the chicken business altogether or sort of double down on it and put up more houses.
One of the things reports that was a line in this report that said we are not trying to create or exacerbate this kind of urban-rural divide and make this a debate. But what the essence of this, and maybe I'm misreading part of it, was that cities, urban areas, are highly regulated. They're paying a great deal more money than agricultural community, and that is part of the source of the problem.
Right. And we're seeing a lot of people are watching Des Moines, Iowa right now.
Yeah. Talk about that. Yeah.
It is really interesting, I think. I'm sort of a manure nerd, I guess. but I do.
An M-head.
Yes. I can call myself that, I guess. Right. So but yeah, it's really interesting because we've seen lawsuits over water quality from industrial animal agriculture in the past. There's been one in the Tulsa, and Arkansas and Oklahoma, which I wrote about. But what's interesting in the Des Moines case is they didn't sue a poultry company or a city. They sued three rural counties. And the deal in Iowa is that in order to farm Iowa.
They being the EPA?
Yeah. I'm sorry. What was
you
the
said
question?
They sued.
The Des Moines Water Works sued three rural counties that drain into the two rivers that support the water for Des Moines, which is a city of 500,000 people. So basically what happened in Iowa is Iowa was essentially a wetland prairie. And in order to farm Iowa in the 1880s, somebody figured out that if you dug these tile drains, you could drain the land and then you could farm. And so there are thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of these tile drains that are sort of subterranean conduits for nutrients, for pollution in Iowa. And they have been slowly infiltrating the water supplies of not just Des Moines, but other cities. And they are loaded with nitrates. And so Des Moines Water Works built a facility to clean the nitrates out of its water. There's a standard of 10 milligrams per liter that you cannot go over. So they have to clean it. And they found that they were having to do it much more often, to run this technology much more often, and it was costing money that they were going to have to pass on to their ratepayers. And so they filed a lawsuit against the counties north of them. And a lot of people are paying attention to what happens here because it's sort of frightening in some ways to have, you know, a city sue other residents as opposed to a company or a state, but sue your neighbors, essentially. But also it clearly got to a point where they didn't feel that they could solve it any other way. I mean, I think their backs were kind of against a wall here, and they had tried collaborative approaches, and other places in Iowa are trying these sort of collaborative approaches, like, you know, doing more practices on the land, like Cedar Rapids is doing that. But so I think it's interesting that it was because they didn't want to increase the rates for the residents of Des Moines that they did this.
So a couple of things. I mean, A, that there's a very interesting piece of this report, but that, I mean, Iowa is a much more intense agricultural state than we are.
That's right.
Right. And that this would happen in an intense agricultural state is really, A, that's kind of fascinating. But what lessons does that have for us? I mean, what does it say? So that was out there. So talk a bit about what that says about how that could be applied or what we can learn here in Maryland from that.
Well, we are in Maryland, in this part of Maryland, are getting our water from the reservoirs.
Right.
It comes from the gunpowder here and then from other reservoirs and other places. So we're not exactly in that situation
right. In
terms of nitrates in our drinking water. But, you know, we have the Potomac River, which feeds Washington, D.C., suburban Maryland, and the Fairfax, Virginia, and Arlington County area. Millions of people get their water from the Potomac. There's a lot of poultry on the Potomac. There's a lot of other nutrients on the Potomac coming from rural areas in the Shenandoah and elsewhere. And so I do think it's something we have to start thinking about, that if we're going to have to start treating water, as more and more people move into D.C., which they do, it's one of the growing areas of the country. It has lots of jobs and continues to do so. We're going to have to figure out a way to make sure that we can supply clean water to all those people. And we might get into a situation where we have to look at that. So in Iowa, it's a drinking water issue, which is perhaps what's sort of moving the ball on the lawsuit.
Right.
But it's more than just drinking water. I mean, the Chesapeake Bay, we're always concerned about all the living resources in the bay. We're seeing intersex fish. We're seeing lesions on fish. We're seeing an unhealthy ecosystem. We've got issues with oversedimentation of our oyster beds. You know, we've had dips in the crab population. So it's not just the human health that we're concerned about, but also all these other factors, which agriculture pollution plays a key role in them.
So I doubt there's going to be a suit against – who knows? Another suit for a while against the farms, which who knows will happen. But clearly the report starts talking about the Chesapeake Bay. Let's take a step backwards. I mean, that's actually saying in the report here that you can't really understand where we are or where we have to go unless you understand our history, which I thought was a key point. And then you delineate from 1983 down about what happened with these original agreements and why things seem to fall apart. And I think that's a story we keep hearing, but we really don't understand the chronology or what exactly happened or why it began, but why we could never meet the goals and it kept being pushed off and pushed off.
Well, yeah, it is really interesting. And it has to do with kind of this sense about even the regulatory sectors, it's still a bit hard to enforce and regulate because you need people to enforce, you need staff, you need budgets. And we keep bringing in more people into the state of Maryland. And so you make progress in reducing pollution, but then you build more, and so you're creating more impervious surface and you're creating more stormwater, and that creates more pollution. I think that our sewage treatment in Maryland has been a huge success. We have really made major progress there. But in a lot of other areas like stormwater and agriculture pollution, we haven't made as much progress as we would certainly like to make. And we're getting to a point, which is Tom Horton's phrase, of diminishing returns with the sewage, where we can spend a whole lot more money to get a small reduction versus what we can spend on agriculture pollution reduction, pound for pound difference. So, you know, it is instructive to look over the past 40 years of the Bay Agreement,
right,
and see, you know, what hasn't been done. And for a lot of it, and this is the part of the report that Tom Horton and Tom Simpson wrote, we have been giving farmers wrong information for many years.
From the 1940s when they said, as you say in the report, put all the phosphorus and nitrogen you want, just lay it on the fields. You need to do that so you can grow food. And that's literally what they did.
Right. I mean, right? They used to say, somebody, a professor at Penn State, put it to me this way, that, you know, they used to say that nitrogen was like 50 ways to leave your lover. The nitrogen would escape any way it could. It would get off through the air. It would dissipate. It would run off. But phosphorus was a clinger. Phosphorus would stay. And if you put phosphorus on your land, you didn't need to worry. If you can control the erosion, you could control the phosphorus. Well, since about the mid-1990s, we have learned that that's not true. Phosphorus will run off as well. And not only that, but it will seep into the subsurface pathways and get into the groundwater and cause terrible problems, algae blooms, and all kinds of other things. But you can't necessarily just say, oh, it's the farmer's fault, because we told them to do certain things and they did those certain things. And then we came back, I say we, the regulators and the university scientists, and we said, oh, hey, the information's changed now. Now you have to do something else. And it takes a long time for change to happen.
Yep.
And we also, I think, in some ways tied their hands, because we've said to them, okay, you can't apply manure anymore, but they have no place to put it. So now, like Arkansas, which is the state that I went to for the report, has a very robust private enterprise manure, basically a manure market where you can buy and sell it as a commodity. We don't have that here. We have a state-funded manure transport, but it doesn't quite work the same way. And so now you have farmers who are basically saying, with this phosphorus management limitation that's coming, you know, we don't have any place to put this stuff. And, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think if you're going to put a limit on what you can do, you need to give people solutions.
So you do. And I think you're describing why when the Chesapeake Bay Commission signed this agreement in 1987, they said we're going to have 40% reduction of nitrogen and phosphorus by the year 2000, and why it didn't happen and still hasn't happened, that's the problem. So the question is, what's the solution? I mean, right now you look at – I was thinking of this. I was reading this that I think – I may have this incorrect, but you can correct me. the money being given, $14 billion of that money is being spent around urban areas and sewage, and only one – and less than a billion in kind of managing what's happening in agricultural lands.
Yes.
And one of the things you're positing is that that has to be switched somehow.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want less money being spent in Baltimore, because no matter what they do on the Eastern Shore, we've got some serious problems in Baltimore. And no matter what happens with ag, we will continue to have serious problems in Baltimore. So I don't think we are suggesting in the report, or we certainly don't mean to, that there should be less urban investment. I think what we're saying is that there should be more emphasis on reducing pollution on farms. And second part of that, very important part of that, is that whatever you do on the farms needs to be independently verified and audited, and to make sure that the practice that you're put in is working. So you're not giving somebody credit. We have a model that sort of estimates pollution and credits people for practices. So you're not giving somebody credit for a practice that's maybe not working. And this is kind of an interesting example. I was just in Iowa doing a story about this practice called the saturated buffer. And I was talking to the scientist who basically invented it. And he said, well, they're between 20 and 80% effective. And I said, well, that's a huge spread. What do you mean? And he said, well, the more we put them in, the more we realized what made them effective and what didn't. So the ones that we put in early in Illinois maybe are only 20% effective. But the ones that we've been putting in more recently in Iowa, it's close to 80. And that has to do with, you know, they monitored it. They looked to see if it was on a steep slope. How close was it to the water? I mean, the first time you put in something like that, it's not going to be perfect. It takes years and years of sort of figuring out what works and what doesn't to put them in properly. And it's only because they were monitoring, because it's a research institution, that they were able to kind of see that. And so now, from now on, they can put in ones that are 80 and maybe even 90% effective, and maybe even redo the earlier ones. So, I mean, that's what we're sort of saying, is that you don't want to have a range of 20 to 80. You want to see all 80s. And if it's 20, you should be maybe not getting credit for that, not getting an 80 credit when you should be getting a 20 credit.
So when I was thinking about this, also as I was reading the report, I was thinking about the stormwater runoff controversy in the state of Maryland. We can't even implement that. When you talk about agricultural runoff and stormwater runoff are probably two of the biggest issues we face in terms of the Chesapeake Bay.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
And especially now with fertilizers and more on lawns and how that's playing into the stormwater runoff in suburban urban areas as well. But there's no agreement on how much tax to pay. There's no – and people are rescinding the taxes. Baltimore County, as you alluded to earlier, is going to rescind the tax. So I'm wondering if the both in terms of policy and the politics of this report that comes out of this report, I mean, how do you begin to wrestle with that? How do you begin to kind of talk about that politically?
I would say – I mean, at this point, we can't get Congress to agree on anything. I think asking them to somehow amend the Clean Water Act to – regulate ag is a non-starter.
It's not going to happen this year or next year or the year after, probably.
Yeah. I mean, we can't even really, you know, get a Water Resources Act to pay for some basic things that we need. So, I mean, the exemption is the exemption is the exemption. What I would say is what we need to do is start taking this more seriously, spending more money on it, investing in practices. There's not a lot of people who know how to develop and put in these practices. I mean, we have thousands of people working for environmental groups in Maryland, and I don't think very many of them know how to technically put in a saturated buffer or a, you know, bioreactor or a lot of these technologies. So when farmers want to do stuff, they have a hard time finding people who are able to know how to do that stuff. So that's one thing, to invest in those practices and invest in a core of people who know how to put them in. In terms of the stormwater fee, I would say that I think it's been badly misunderstood. I would hope that the residents of Maryland, if they understood what it was actually for, wouldn't mind paying it, because it is extremely important. And the small amount that they were asking us to pay is not nearly enough to take care of the problem.
Right.
And the bill that we have is long overdue, because we've done absolutely nothing in some cases on stormwater. And I think a lot of people don't realize that water just flows right in from our streets untreated into our streams. I mean, I can watch it happen near where I live, and you probably can too. And I think it was just – it came at a time when a lot of people were sick of paying another fee and another fee and another fee. And I think it got lost in a lot of the other rhetoric about fees and taxes. And I think it was really a missed opportunity because it is extremely important that we have a designated fee and that we end up paying. And the fee may go away, but we still have the mandate to pay it. And one way or another, you can bet Baltimore City and Baltimore County and everybody else is going to find a way to get that money. And we're going to pay for it in one way or another through a property tax or some other creative way.
So going back to the report itself, I mean, and what you're suggesting here, that when you – it was interesting. We just talked about stormwater. There was a piece in here that really caught my eye about the remediation fees for stormwater can be $100,000 per acre, $150 to $400 a foot for restoring urban streams, which is a huge amount of money,
right.
And three times as much when compared to reductions in farmland to nitrogen, about 10 times as much for phosphorus in the 2012 assessment. So so what is the report saying then about I might say it, but I want you to say it since you wrote the report. What's the report saying about what the recommendations are about where to go?
I think the report is basically saying that it doesn't – there's a part of it that talks about stormwater, but
– No, most of it's about agriculture.
Right.
Yeah, right, right.
Basically that we need to do more and we need to independently monitor and verify that the things that we're doing are making sense, and we need to invest in technologies that will get us to where we need to go. My – part of that talked about manure and energy
right.
technologies. But there are many other technologies that we can use to basically take it seriously. And you know, it's not about meeting a goal or meeting a milestone. It's about actually reducing the pollution, you know, seeing a benefit to people in terms of the quality of the water and the quality of the air, and not about just, you know, meetings and goalposts, but about real change.
But in that real change, the way it seems to be described in this report, A, takes a lot of money.
Yes.
For agriculture to be monitored.
Right.
And B, politically, it's a battle because, as you know, as I know, many people know, the farmers are a very conservative group that don't like people telling them what to do.
Right.
Or looking over their shoulder as they're doing their work, right? So talk about what you all talked about in terms of that. And maybe you're not in the report completely, but I mean, that seems to me the money and how this oversight works and how this is going to get measured is the issue.
Right. Well, farmers are, especially the ones in the Midwest that I met, are not interested in any more regulation.
Right.
They don't like it, but they are interested in practices that will clean up their environment. And I think that the ones that I've met, and this is always a bit of a tricky question because any farmer that's going to let a reporter on their land and ask them questions for, you know, 2 or 3 hours is probably going to be a pretty progressive person who cares about the environment and is willing to talk about what they're doing and show off their farm. So you don't necessarily talk to the quote unquote bad actors because they're not inviting you on. So, you know, nearly all of the farmers I meet are progressive, you know, good stewards of the land, people who care deeply, people who are trying their best. Their complaint about regulation is more about paperwork and, you know, having to pay fees for stuff that they don't really see as necessary and, you know, taking time away from working the land and trying to figure out solutions rather than, you know, pushing papers.
So how do you get – I mean, so when you write in here that only 8% of the farmland is really monitored in the state of Maryland in any significant way, that the reports for the farms that are not CAFOs mm-hmm. are proprietary, so you can't see what's going on, that farmers do not want more paperwork, but that the monitoring has to happen somehow to ensure this is happening throughout the agricultural system. How does that happen?
That's a good question. I don't know how you reduce the load of paperwork that they currently have, but I think that a verification and independent monitoring network could possibly be structured in a way that doesn't necessarily involve them. I mean, if you put in places on their land to test for water samples. A lot of this can be done over the computer, and
which is the original idea of the phosphorus management tool,
right? Exactly,
in its first iteration,
right? That
right?
was many iterations ago, right? Yeah. So, I mean, and also talking about, you know, these things being expensive. It was just recently announced that there's a budget surplus in Maryland.
Right.
Now, somebody at the press conference for the report suggested to Secretary Ben Grumbles, wouldn't it be great if we used some of this budget surplus to hire more inspectors for the Maryland Department of the Environment to jointly with Maryland Department of Agriculture inspect some farms and do more verification, or maybe use that money to set up a verification network within the state. He didn't really respond to that particular idea, other than that he welcomed, you know, more money and more inspectors and that kind of thing. But you know, MDA, Maryland Department of the Environment, has always been short on inspectors for ag or for sewage or for any of it. It's just never been a priority of the various administrations to put enough inspectors in to really do the job. And that is a bipartisan, I guess, observation that in my opinion, they've never really had enough people. They're always short staffed when it comes to that kind of work.
So let's kind of talk a bit about here at the end about the recommendations you made in terms of where this report goes. What should happen to what's in this report?
Well, we would hope that one thing that happens is that the state of Maryland, as we're reaching this midpoint assessment for our progress with the total maximum daily load, that we look to do more monitoring and make an independent verification network where we are sure that the reductions that we're paying for and that we say we're getting, we are actually getting, and that this be an independent auditor that's separate from the state, so that it can be sort of independent, I guess is the word, unbiased, and just kind of check to make sure these things are being done right. At the same time, look at new technologies for manure to energy and other pollution-reducing technologies. I think that some of the things I've seen out in the Midwest, some really interesting practices with drainage that we're only really starting to do here. Maryland is the envy of many places because we do get a lot of money for cover crops and buffer strips and all that kind of stuff. But we haven't been really putting in a lot of drainage practices, which is to reduce the phosphorus and nitrogen at the source of the drain, which is where it gets into the stream. We've done some in Caroline County in particular. Drew Coslow has been doing a lot of that with Choptank Riverkeeper and now on his own. And there's a couple other people, Tom Fisher of the University of Maryland, who have been monitoring it. But there just hasn't been a lot of it. And I think now we're starting to see Maryland, the Maryland Department of Agriculture, adapt more of these practices. Now, they are expensive. They are more expensive than, you know, sort of taking an acre and doing cover crops, because you are taking land out of production. But I think there's kind of this sense here and in other places that maybe it's not the greatest idea to farm to the very edge, that we take some land out and we put it in buffers and we create not just a sponge for the land, but some habitat for things like monarch butterflies and a lot of the things that we've lost, which farmers deeply care about that too. So they just need to be compensated for it and for us to make sure that what we think is happening is actually happening. So the verification, I think, is probably the biggest recommendation to come out of this report, is that we need to just make sure that what we say we're doing is actually making a difference.
Ronald Coble has been a journalist for the last 20 years, worked for The Sun for at least a decade, and staff writer of Chesapeake Bay, along with Dr. Robert Summers and Dr. Tom Simpson, and also a journalist and author, Tom Horton, produced this report, The Chesapeake Bay and Agricultural Pollution, The Problem, Possible Solutions, and the Need for Verification, put out by the Able Foundation. It just came out, and we'll be linked to it on our website at soundshow.org and at soundbitesradio.org. And I want to thank so much. It's really important work, and we look forward to kind of playing with this some more with some other series of guests in you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Delmarva Public Radio is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Twin Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also learn more about Soundbites and listen to past episodes at soundbitesradio.org. For your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.